sipping chic cocktails I've never heard of, with names like Negroni and Paloma. I back away onto the grass. The last thing I want is to get snared in a web of small talk with the Bellamy's friends. I can feel their eyes roving across my skin, even though I've pinned my hair up under a broad-rimmed sun hat in my best attempt to look un-Zoe-ish. I'm not entirely sure it's working. The more I listen to Martina's podcast, the more I learn about Zoe and her strange disappearance, the more I wonder what I'm doing here. It can't be a coincidence, this job, my mysteriously missing doppelganger. But I don't have the first clue what any of it means. On the front lawn, I slip into the shade of the long white tent that has been set up kitty-corner to the fountain and tennis court and fill a small plate with purple carrots and mushroom tartlets. Most of the guests are mingling by the pool. This side of Clovelly Cottage is almost deserted, save for the kids, who are turning cartwheels across the tennis court. I park myself at a tall, round cocktail table in the shade where I can rest my elbows and keep an eye on Paisley. What a charming sundress. The compliment is laced with something like pity or scorn. I spin around. The speaker is a tall, older woman with a body shaped like a bowling pin. She leans primly against the lip of the fountain, an actual parasol propped on the drive in front of her. Slender arms sprout from narrow, sloped shoulders. A trim waist swells abruptly into ample hips and thighs beneath a fluttering skirt. She is dressed head to toe in white. Thank you? I'm not sure how she snuck up on me. From where I'm standing, I have a clear view of the drive. And if she'd already been around back at the pool, I'm sure I would have noticed her among the other younger guests in their effortless summer dresses and pressed linen suits. She leans forward, using her parasol as a cane, and takes 3 steps toward me. I can't tell if she's 50 or 75. Take off your hat, she demands. When I hesitate, she makes an impatient gesture in the air with her hand. Well, go on. Slowly, I slip my sun hat off and place it on the cocktail table. She's surly but authoritative, and I feel oddly compelled to obey her. Beneath my hat, a few bobby pins have come undone. Loose bits of hair fall limply down my shoulders and back. She's standing next to me at the table now, uncomfortably close. I get the sense she's appraising me like a slightly damaged antique overvalued at auction. Not as striking as I'd been led to believe, but I do see a sickly sort of resemblance, mostly in the cheekbones and hair. It hits me all at once who this woman must be. She looks like the painting, but much older. Mrs. Talbot? I venture. She takes a small step back to extend one pale hand. Unlike everyone else I've encountered in Heron Mills, her skin decidedly lacks an early summer tan. Yes, she replies. I take her hand in mine, and a small shiver runs through me. It's very cold, and her grip is tight. I'm Anna, I manage to choke out. But I guess you knew that already. Anna Ciccone, the au pair. She releases my hand from her grasp. This time I recognize the note in her voice. Judgment. Just then, a thin wail rises from the tennis court. A chubby girl with curly brown hair is on the ground, clutching what looks like a freshly skinned knee. Paisley's erstwhile best friend, Claudia.
Anna!
Paisley shouts, waving wildly, even though I'm only a few yards away. You'd better go. Mrs. Talbot's voice pitches into a thin sneer that says plainly what she thinks of my nannying skills. I want to protest that I've been watching them until she showed up, that Claudia isn't even my responsibility, but I feel babyish in the shadow of her glare, silenced. Without saying anything, I rush off toward the girls on the court. I know where the Bellamys keep their first aid kit. It's only a scraped knee. I'll get Claudia fixed up in no time. I can be good at this job. I've got this. And Anna, Mrs. Talbot says, as Paisley slips her hand into mine, pulling me over to inspect Claudia's wound. I turn my head to face her once more. I won't expect to see you at Windermere again. We don't need anything stirred up. She doesn't wait for me to respond, parasol propped over her shoulder, making me wonder if its previous use as a cane was entirely performative. She spins on her heel and starts off across the lawn toward the deep thicket of trees that separate Clovelly Cottage from Windermere. I see then how she arrived so stealthily on the grounds. She didn't come up the drive at all, but simply slipped through the trees between the properties. I whip back around and scoop a wailing Claudia into my arms. With instructions to Paisley to take the other girls to the pool deck where their parents can see them, I head across the drive toward the front door. At a few minutes after 6, as Tom and Paisley splash together in the pool and the guests are starting to depart for their Sunday dinners and end-of-the-weekend rituals, I find myself standing alone at the bar with Amelia. One thin dress strap has slipped down a tan shoulder and her neat bob looks windswept. She gives our order to the bartender, a Negroni for her, seltzer and lime for me. And I notice that her speech is just slightly slurred. I take a deep breath. If I'm about to offend her, maybe she'll be less likely to hold it against me now. Maybe she won't remember tomorrow. Can I ask you a question? Her eyes focus somewhere in the area of my nose. Of course, Anna. It's about the job, I begin. Oh. She frowns. Has it not been what you've expected? It has, I rush to say. Everything's been great. What I mean is, I'm hoping you would tell me why I was hired. Ah. Amelia plucks our drinks from the bar and takes a seat on a lounge chair. She hands over my seltzer, and I perch on a wicker seat beside her. In the pool, Tom tosses Paisley into the air, and she squeals. It was Paisley's choice, really. We interviewed 3 candidates in the spring. We were supposed to see 2 more after you, but we canceled those appointments. Paisley was set on you. Do you know why? I press. Well, Amelia folds her lips together, as if not sure how much to say. I'm sure someone has pointed out by now your resemblance to Zoe Spanos. I nod eagerly. My heart speeds up, a quick rat-a-tat in my chest. This is what I've been waiting for. Someone to tell me that none of this is a coincidence, that I'm here for a reason. It's such a tragedy, Amelia says. She was one of Paisley's favorite babysitters. I think, truthfully, when she saw how much you looked like Zoe, she was won over immediately. And you've been great with her, of course. Tom and I know we made the right choice. She smiles reassuringly, but I'm not sure what I feel. I'm here because of Zoe, because we look alike, and that strange bit of happenstance struck the fancy of a little kid. All those strange looks, awkward conversations, not coincidence after all, not really. You might have warned me, I say, I hope not rudely. I take a big gulp of seltzer through my straw. I'm sorry. Amelia's face clouds over. You're right. We should have. I didn't know how to bring it up, honestly. I was afraid you might not take the job. Do George and Joan? I start to ask. I want to know if Zoe's parents know about me. What if I run into them in town? But before I can finish my question, Amelia cuts me off. What about Joan? Oh, I'm hit with the presumptuousness of my question. Martina's podcast made me feel for a second like I was on a first-name basis with everyone in the Spanos family, the same way characters on TV start to feel like friends. Amelia looks at me sharply, then her eyes wander to Tom, still in the pool. Mentioning Mrs. Spanos clearly pushed some kind of button, and I forget why I even brought her up. Nothing. Never mind. Amelia's face relaxes. We didn't only hire you because of that, you know. You interviewed well. You were fantastic with Paisley during our trial run at MoMA. Don't think I let Paisley entirely steer the ship. She laughs and leans back in the chaise, hair fanning out against the back of the chair. Right, of course not. But it's clear now. I got this job because of the missing girl. It doesn't explain everything I've been feeling. The rush of nostalgia at the beach, the odd moment at the ice cream shop, the wave of vertigo peering up at the balcony at Windermere. But it's something. A rational explanation for the way in which my fate and Zoe's have oddly intertwined. Mary is off tonight, and I'm instructed to help myself to party leftovers in the kitchen if I get hungry later. I feel the opposite of hungry. No, that's not quite right. I feel hollow and like nothing could ever make me solid again. As soon as the last guests have departed and it seems socially acceptable, I slip into the pool house and latch the door behind me. Tearing off my hat and sundress, I turn the hot water all the way up, filling the bathtub. I need a long, long soak. I feel more than just sweaty and hot. I feel violated somehow, and at the same time, like I'm the one who's done something wrong. I'm an interloper in Heron Mills, in Caden Talbot's world, even though I didn't mean to be. Even though the Bellamys invited me in. I slip into the bathtub, gritting my teeth until my skin adjusts to the scalding water. I don't have bubble bath, so I pour some shower gel beneath the tap until it forms a few lackluster suds. My phone is propped on the edge of the tub. I've barely had it for 2 weeks, and there's already a scratch on the top left corner of the screen. I think about putting on music. I should put on music. But my finger traces the scratch, then navigates to my podcasts. I don't want to listen anymore, but I need to know. I press play on episode 3. Martina Green is struggling. I turn the volume all the way up and sink down in the bath, breathing in the steam. The third episode of Missing Zoe is dedicated to interviews with the people closest to Zoe, but by the last week of February, 8 weeks after she vanished, Caden has still declined Martina's interview requests, and the Spanos family is, understandably, not ready to speak to a teen podcast producer about the very open wound left by the disappearance of their beloved daughter and sister. It's palpable in the interviews that Martina does get, with a teacher from their high school, a couple of friends, and the volunteer coordinator at the animal shelter where Zoe used to walk dogs and clean cages during high school. That with every passing week, the likelihood that Zoe will return alive and unharmed has diminished. I do the mental math. It's June 28th. That means it's been almost 18 weeks since Martina recorded this episode and 26 weeks total since Zoe disappeared. It will be 6 months on Tuesday. There's still one episode of Missing Zoe remaining, but I know she hasn't been found. After episode 4, Martina's trail went cold. I listened to Zoe's teacher talk about her academic promise, how she excelled in math and science, how she was a student leader, involved in multiple clubs and activities, how it came as no surprise when Zoe landed the internship in California the summer after her first year at Brown, when those spots were typically reserved for juniors. I listened to her friends talk about her bright and easygoing personality, how she loved animals and baking, how she planned something thoughtful for all her friends' birthdays without fail every single year. She didn't drink, brought huge pitchers of her own juice blends to parties, which somehow everyone thought was endearing, not dorky. She loved Caden. She loved her family. She had the most volunteer hours in her graduating class. It's a nice character study of Zoe. It's clear that everyone liked her. All the episode seems to prove is how unlikely it is that Zoe Spanos had any enemies in Heron Mills. Martina ends the episode on a hopeful note that she'll still get to talk to Caden, to Aster, to George and Joan Spanos, that she'll uncover information the police discarded or didn't think was important about the fall leading up to that night, the night itself. But I saw the way Martina looked at Aster on Main Street earlier this week. It was a look of failure, a look I know really well. By the end of the episode, the water has turned lukewarm and my fingers have puckered into prunes, but I don't want to get out. "I'm sorry," I whisper out loud, although I'm not quite sure why. I'm sorry we look alike. I'm sorry you're gone and I'm here in Heron Mills where you should be. I'm sorry I stepped unwittingly into your life. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. "I'm sorry," I say again. The urge to apologize is strong, the need clawing at my throat like angry talons. "I'm so sorry, Zoe." I stumble out of the tub and dry myself off. Wrapped in my robe with my hair twisted in a towel on top of my head, I sit in the center of the bed and open Google. I type Zoe Spanos into the search bar and click through the first few results. Most links take me to news articles from January about Zoe's disappearance, then a few more recent posts with paltry, unsatisfying updates. There are a couple older hits from the Jefferson website and the school paper's online archive. Most compelling of all, there's an open-access web forum set up by Zoe's college friends where people from all facets of her life, Brown, Jefferson, Heron Mills, and beyond, have posted everything from theories to photos to open messages for Zoe. I read everything. Then I read through her LinkedIn profile, her intern bio from last summer on the Research Center's website, even a long article about Brown's fundraising campaign for a new campus lab that quotes Zoe only once, but I somehow read through to the end. By the time my phone warns me it's reached 15% battery life, it's almost midnight. Eyes stinging and skin crawling with the persistent sensation that there's something ever so slightly familiar about everything I just found. I reach for my charger, then force myself to turn off the light.
Chapter 10. Now, September. Heron Mills, New York. Martina sits on the family room couch with Mommy, suffering through the commercial break before the 8 o'clock news. Pampers, Coleridge Audi, a new drug treatment for fibromyalgia. She wishes her dad were here to cut the tension in the room with his warm smile and quick laugh, but he's at the shop, closing up for the night. Martina has two siblings, both brothers, both older, both no longer living at home, so it's just Martina and Mommy tonight. Mommy thinks her daughter's interest in the Zoe Spanos case is unhealthy, morbid. But even Mommy can't tear her eyes away from the screen tonight because the autopsy report for Zoe is about to be released. All of Heron Mills is watching. Martina fidgets with her phone, shoots Aster a quick text. You okay? It joins the chain of five others Martina has sent her best friend today. They're all unread. Martina last heard from Aster early this morning. She was in the car with her parents, on their way to meet with someone from the medical examiner's office. Martina thought she might get the news straight from Aster, but she didn't come to school today. And she's been silent since this morning's text.
Autopsy results are in. We have to drive all the way to Hop Hog. I feel sick, and Mom literally threw up before we got in the car. I don't know if I can handle this.
Whatever the report said, Zoe is still dead. It's not a good day. Still, Martina curls her hands into fists beneath her thighs, keeps her eyes trained on the screen as the local newscaster, a brightly rouged woman with a frosty blonde bob seated behind a desk in the NBC New York newsroom, opens the segment.
Breaking news in Suffolk County tonight. Autopsy results were released this morning to George and Joan Spanos, parents of Zoe Spanos, who disappeared on her way to a house party in the Long Island village of Heron Mills last New Year's Eve. The missing girl's body was found submerged in a small boat in Parrish Lake last month, just over 2 miles from her home. Channel 4 has the latest.
The words, new information, flash in silver block letters across the screen, as the newscaster introduces a young reporter with a thin smile and wire-rimmed glasses to match, standing inside the busy front hall of an administrative building somewhere in Suffolk County. On the couch beside Martina, Mommy clasps and unclasps her hands in her lap.
Thanks, Katie. What we know right now is that autopsy results were released to the victim's family earlier today, but they have not yet been made public. We're expecting a representative from the medical examiner's office to give a statement shortly.
The camera cuts to a wooden podium in a room not quite as packed with reporters as Martina would have hoped. Across the front of the microphone-studded podium hangs a gold and black seal with the figure of an ox surrounded by the words Suffolk County Seal, New York, Freedom and Independence. Above it hangs a cardboard identification card for Daniel Medina, supervisor, Medical Forensic Investigations. The Jenkins women grit their teeth through three local news stories until Daniel Medina is ready to speak. When he comes to the podium, he has a prepared statement in hand. Martina leans toward the screen as he rustles the papers before him. Mommy raises one hand to her lips. Daniel tells the room that the forensic medical investigators and pathologists could not determine a cause of death due to the advanced state of decomposition in which Zoe's body was found. Hot bile floods the back of Martina's throat, and Mommy whimpers, clasps her hands in her lap. But what they can confirm is shocking. Zoe Spanos did not have any broken bones when she died. Which means Anna's story about Zoe falling to her death from the third floor balcony of Windermere? Impossible. Martina's pulse begins to race. Martina fidgets in her desk chair in the back of the chemistry lab, which Miss Foxrigg has kindly agreed to let her use for her interview. The interview. She can't be home for this. Can't risk Mommy walking through the door while she's recording. While she's supposed to be at an SAT study session, she's currently blowing off. Besides, the lab has the best acoustics. For the next hour, it's all hers. She checks her phone, again. 3:56. In 4 minutes, she'll put through the call to Pathways. She wonders how much Anna knows, how much she's been told. She has to know at least as much as has been made public over the last 48 hours. Her lawyers would be keeping her up to speed. In the past day, Anna's mother has hired two more, a real legal team. It's been all over the news. Martina pulls up Pathways in her contacts and presses the green call button on her phone. Her recording equipment is all set to go. She's ready. Martina? Anna, hi. Before we start, can you do me a favor? They monitor everything we do online here, and there's an address I need you to look up for me. Anna's voice trails off. Sure, Martina says. She agrees to look it up before they end the call. I'm going to start recording now, okay? Martina tries to keep her voice steady, calm, professional. She digs her nails into her palm. Yeah, yes. Martina draws in a deep breath. She had so much she'd planned to ask Anna today, but the autopsy news has blown everything out of the water. The answer is, I don't know, Anna says before Martina has a chance to speak. Then Anna laughs, a hollow tinny sound funneled through the miniature speaker on Martina's phone. What? Martina is caught off guard. Sorry, it wasn't funny. It's a quote from an old movie. They don't have anything from this century in this place. Anna clears her throat. You were going to ask what really happened that night. Now that the autopsy results have come in. You were going to ask how Zoe died, if she didn't fall from that balcony. Right, Martina says, regaining her composure. Is there anything you can tell me? Anything you remember? Honestly, no. I remember being on the balcony with Zoe. I remember falling. I thought she fell. And what do you think now, Anna? I don't know what to think. I've been here a whole month. I've had nothing but time to think. A pause. Then Anna starts to sing. Time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the future. In the lilt of Anna's voice, Martina detects a tinge of something that sounds like hysteria. She clears her throat. I should have it all figured out by now, she continues. But it seems like I never knew what I was talking about. Anna's words are podcast gold. She just admitted to lying to police, didn't she? Martina makes an effort to steady her voice, to tamp the giddiness down. Are you saying you weren't responsible for Zoe's death? Or that she didn't die in the way you told police? There is a long pause, and for a moment, Martina wonders if she's lost Anna, if she's still on the other end of the line. When Anna finally speaks, she doesn't answer Martina's question. My lawyers say this is good news. They didn't want me to do this interview, but I don't really care. I need to know what happened. I really need to know. And I think you're going to figure it out, Martina. I trust you. Martina steadies her palms against the desk. She's glad she's alone, that no one can see the way her eyes flash and shimmer, how she can barely force her feet to stay planted on the floor. She tries another angle. The night you spoke with Detective Holloway and Assistant Detective Massey, August 5th, were you telling the truth? Anna draws in a deep breath. I told them what I remembered, and those memories haven't gone away. But I was under a lot of stress that night, more than I realized. Did you know I was in that interview room for 7 hours? Eventually, I just wanted the questions to stop. So I told them what I remembered, and my brain filled in the blanks. Or they filled them in for me. What kind of blanks? There's this gap after the Windermere balcony. I don't remember driving to Parrish Lake or putting Zoe in that boat. I never remembered any of that. I remember being by the water, though, after, knowing she was down there, that I could never get her back. I told the police I must have taken her body to the lake because it fit. Because they told me I must have done it. At the time, it seemed like the answer to a question I'd been chasing all summer. Why did you confess, Anna? I don't know how to explain it. I remembered feelings, scraps of things. I had all these scraps and nowhere to fit them. And then, after what Caden said, suddenly they all shifted into place. It was the only story that made sense. Did you kill Zoe Spanos? For a moment, the sound of Anna's breathing is the only sign that she's still there, that she hasn't hung up like Martina still fears she might. I do not believe I killed Zoe Spanos or concealed her body. Blood rushes to Martina's head, and she focuses on her phone's black screen. And do you have any idea who did? Anything that could help the investigation move forward? I think, Anna says slowly, it's time for Caden Talbot to speak to the police.
Part 2. The Stable. We can never go back again. That much is certain. The past is still too close to us. Daphne du Maurier, Rebecca. Chapter 11. Then, June. Riverhead and Heron Mills, New York. Paisley wants to do the penguin encounter at the Long Island Aquarium, so on Monday morning, Amelia calls to book 2 tickets for the 1:30 group, then hands over the keys to her car. I've driven it a couple times, little errands around Heron Mills, but it's about 45 minutes to Riverhead, and the pending drive makes my nerves spike. I've had my license for a year now, but I don't have much highway experience. Plus, this time, I'll have Paisley with me. I hide my jitters beneath a big smile, reminding myself I learned to drive in Brooklyn. I can handle Long Island. The drive is undeniably beautiful. While Paisley entertains herself in the back with Amelia's iPad, I will the scenery to soothe my nerves as we coast from the south to North Fork. Lakeshores, vineyards, farmland, and the largest golf course I've ever seen. But I can't relax. My palms are slippery with sweat on the wheel, and every electronic chime from Paisley's game makes me flinch. About halfway there, the puffy clouds above us darken, and rain splatters the windshield. It's barely more than a drizzle. The sun is still shining through the clouds, but my entire body tenses. As raindrops patter against the roof and the road becomes wet and black beneath us, all I can imagine is losing control, tires skidding across the highway, our small car colliding with oncoming traffic. My vision fills with smoke, blood, broken glass. I twist around, seatbelt biting into my neck, and a small whimper escapes my lips. Paisley's broken body is slumped across the back seat. Through the smashed window, dark water rushes in, filling the car, my nose, my lungs.
You okay, Anna?
Paisley is asking. I breathe. The water retreats. Fine, I manage. Twist back around, focus on the road. I flex my fingers against the wheel, unknot the cramps.
What was that?
Paisley's fine. We're both fine. Heart still hammering, I drive at 5 miles under the speed limit until the sky clears up and we leave the rain behind. Google Maps directs me into the parking lot, and we spend the remainder of the morning at the indoor exhibits, everything from alligators to sand sharks to marmosets, while we wait for our scheduled time with the penguins, and I'm still fine. No more dark visions. No panic knotting inside my chest. By the time we meet our penguin expert and guide at the Aquatic Adventures sign, the morning's drive feels like it happened to another girl. Max Adler is tall and muscular, with a mop of brown hair, and looks like he spends a lot of time in the sun. He's young, maybe early 20s, and very enthusiastic about the African penguins with whom we're about to get up close and personal. Paisley, who has been chattering nonstop about the little black and white waddlers since we got here, suddenly gets quiet and tugs on my hand. I crouch down next to her.
"What's up?"
I whisper.
"Does he have to be our guide?"
she asks in my ear. I frown. "I think so, yeah. Do you know him?" We're missing the rundown of the rules and regulations, and I give Max half a smile to show I'm paying attention. When our eyes meet, he pauses just long enough to garner some curious glances from the rest of the tour group. Then he seems to collect his thoughts and continues.
"I've seen him around,"
Paisley whispers. Unsure what that means, but fairly certain we're in no immediate danger from the penguin guy, I give her hand a reassuring squeeze and straighten up. Max finishes his overview, then leads us toward the penguin pavilion. As soon as we're inside the exhibit, Paisley visibly relaxes. The squat little birds are adorable, swimming, sunning themselves, and napping in little hutches nestled along the back wall. We learn that the average lifespan of the African penguin is 15 to 30 years, and that the birds at the Long Island Aquarium were imported illegally into the U.S. from South Africa, where they had been captive bred. They've been living in the pavilion since the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service intervened in 2004. Another staffer, Molly, takes over to explain penguin care and handling, and that everyone in the group will get to meet a fluffy, heart-melting little penguin chick, which is totally worth every penny of Amelia's money. As we wait for our personal meet and greet, Max walks over to us, and I can feel Paisley stiffen again beside me. He stretches out his hand, and I take it.
"Enjoying your encounter?" he asks.
I'm not much into people's vibes or auras, but everything about Max is signaling friendly and warm. Two dimples crease his cheeks, and I wonder if he's even younger than I originally thought. After this weekend's epic failure with Caden, I need a distraction. I throw Paisley a worried glance as she steps half behind me. "We are," I say. Molly is calling for the next set of volunteers to meet the chick, and I usher Paisley over. "Seems like a pretty great gig," I say, when she's joined Molly at the penguin preschool gate.
"How'd you get into the penguin game?"
"Just graduated from Brown, Ecology and Evolutionary Bio. I'm taking some time before applying to grad programs."
Max goes on to explain how the job isn't just tours and animal care, how he's also heading up a research project at the aquarium and collecting data for some schmancy-sounding scholar. But all I hear is Brown. Biology. Suddenly, the way he caught my eye earlier starts to make a familiar kind of sense, how he singled me out to talk just now.
"So you knew Zoe Spanos?" I ask point blank.
Max stops mid-sentence, suddenly out of words. "I look like her, I know," I go on. "You're a friend of Zoe's? That's why I Paisley recognized you?"
"Oh," Max says, finding his voice again. "I knew Zoe a bit from school. I'd see her around the labs. She was 2 years behind me, though, so we weren't in classes together or anything."
He pauses for a moment.
"Who's Paisley?"
"My friend." I gesture toward Penguin Preschool. "She seemed to know you."
"Huh."
Max looks genuinely perplexed.
"I don't think so. Zoe's from Heron Mills, right? I live out on Montauk. Kind of close, but Zoe and I didn't really hang out off campus."
I don't know why he'd lie about that, so I just shrug.
The fact that he knew Zoe from Brown is a bit of an odd coincidence, but given everything the past week has thrown at me, it barely registers on the weirdness scale. Maybe Paisley mistook him for someone else. Dunno. Max shrugs. For what it's worth, I don't think you two look that much alike. Zoe was so serious. She always seemed like she was in a hurry. I wonder if he knows he's talking about her in the past tense. If it's because he thinks she's dead, or simply because she wasn't on campus last semester, has become a part of his past. Being friendly with the visitors is just part of the job, he continues, and I push Zoe out of my mind.
Swear, it's nothing more than that.
Then you should probably mingle, I say. I have a penguin chick to meet. At the end of our encounter, Paisley and I pose for photos with the birds, and Max holds out a business card with an address and phone number scrawled on the back. This Saturday, if you're free, a few friends and I are having a little get-together on the beach for the 4th. Beer, fireworks, nothing fancy. I'd love to see you there. Anna, I supply.
I'd love to see you there, Anna.
Do you invite all Penguin Pavilion visitors? I ask, and Max blushes. No, this is a personal invitation. Heat pricks my chest, and for the first time in days, I feel genuinely good about myself. Part of me would love a day at the beach, cold beer, no responsibilities. I'd love to, but I can't. I'm taking a break from partying this summer. And besides, I nod toward Paisley, who is saying her goodbyes to her new penguin friends. I'm working.
Okay,
Max shrugs. In case your schedule changes. He presses the card into my hand, and even though I know I won't use it, I slip it into my back pocket. After a week filled with nothing but strange reactions from everyone I've met, I have to admit that a little friendliness and flirting is refreshing. I spend Monday night on the phone, giving my mom the Heron Mills highlights reel, minus any mention of Zoe Spanos. She finally seems to have settled into the reality of my absence. No need to let her know the real reason I got this job. When Mom lets me go, I bite the bullet and try to patch things up with a very incensed Kaylee, then reward my moderately successful efforts with the online shopping spree I've been promising myself. By the end of my second week here, I'll have something new to wear to dinner and several new sun hats to supplement my wardrobe. On Tuesday, I pick up Rachel from the Paulson Gosses and take the girls for a day at the beach. I can feel my life in Heron Mills slipping into a regular, if still unsettling, routine. I do some after-dinner sketches at the pool, Max, Paisley, with the penguins, then Caden again, his face coming to life on the page, even though I tell myself I'd rather forget it. By the time the sun has sunk low behind the tree line and the lights on the pool deck have sprung into action, he's all I can think about. He made it very clear he didn't like me showing up at Windermere last Friday, and Mrs. Talbot flat out told me not to come back. But I can't shake the connection I felt the first night we met, before he got a good look at my face. The need to explain myself swells in my chest. If I could just make Caden understand how much I didn't know, how I wasn't trying to be insensitive, I need one more chance. Armed with the knowledge that I might only make matters worse, I slip on sneakers and the same hoodie I was wearing the first time I walked over to Windermere and grab the flashlight from the kitchen counter. I think about following Mrs. Talbot's lead and walking straight through the trees onto the Windermere grounds. But I can't imagine that would help my case. Instead, I walk around to the front of Clovelly Cottage, noting the light glowing in the family room. Emilia and Paisley are blacked out in silhouette on the couch, the TV flickering in front of them. I'm close to the end of the driveway when I notice someone standing at the entry gate. I raise the flashlight, and a slim figure holds up his arm in front of his eyes, shielding them from the light. He looks like he was about to ring the buzzer. "Caden?" I ask.
"Anna? Sorry to just show up. I didn't have your number."
I lower the flashlight beam to the ground. "It's not a problem." At the gate, I key in the combination and stand back while the doors do their thing. Soon, Caden and I are standing face to face, shrouded in darkness once again.
"Still restless?" he asks.
I can feel him studying my face in the dark. "I was going to take a walk," I hedge, not ready to admit my intended destination. It doesn't seem possible that I read things wrong at Windermere, but I decide to just let this play out.
"I feel bad about the way things went down on Friday. I was in a weird place."
"It's okay. I get it."
"Do over?"
he asks, and I nod, probably too eagerly.
"I can't go far, but if you'll have me for company, we could hang out in the stable."
He steps through the open gates onto the drive.
"Stable?"
By now, I'm certain I've explored every inch of the Clovelly Cottage grounds, and there are definitely no horses.
"At Windermere, but it's faster if we cut through the trees, and less chance my mother will see us."
I let Caden lead the way back up the drive and across the grass. Inside the Bellamy's house, the lights in the family room have gone dark. We cut through the thick copse of trees where I watched Mrs. Talbot disappear on Sunday, flashlight beam bouncing across the ground in front of our feet. It may be pitch dark, but it's only 9 o'clock, and again I am reminded of Caden's curfew, which maybe makes a bit more sense now that I know about Zoe. If your son's girlfriend vanished without a trace, you'd do everything you could to keep him close, even if it was mostly for yourself. As twigs and pine needles snap and crack beneath our feet, it strikes me with a shiver that whatever or whoever came for Zoe last New Year's Eve probably has no respect for curfews or parental best intentions. My mind flashes suddenly to an image of a girl who looks a lot like me, but out of focus, falling, body twisting in a long white party dress with a pale yellow sash. She's young, and a diminutive version of my features, or Zoe's, are frozen in terror on her face. I drop the flashlight to the ground, and the beam flickers out. Caden stops.
"Anna?"
I crouch down and scramble to put my hands on the flashlight in the dark, to make the image go away. My fingers find pine needles and rocks, my mind still snared by the vision or memory. Zoe falling from some great height. Zoe, dead. Caden's standing over me, the light of his phone screen casting a watery glow on the woodsy floor. We spot the flashlight at the same time and both reach for it.
"I'm sorry," he says, as I draw my hand sharply back.
"No, I'm sorry." I grasp the flashlight and push myself up to standing.
"You'd better take this."
I hold it out to him.
"Butterfingers."
Part of me burns to tell Caden what I just saw. But if I'm imagining things, I won't be doing myself any favors by spilling my vision to him. And if what I saw was somehow real, I'm not sure what that means. The possibilities range from unsettling to flat out terrifying, so I shove them back into the dark where they belong. The incident in the car yesterday, and now this,
Something very creepy is going on with my brain, and a small voice at the back of my head says if I know what's good for me, I'll keep my thoughts to myself. We start walking again, and in a minute, we're through the trees and standing in tall, unkempt grass. The few windows on this side of the estate are dark. Caden turns right and guides me along the edge of Windermere, back toward the grounds behind the house. Soon, a barn-like structure that must be the stable comes into view. On the far side, I can see a riding pen. It's hard to be sure in the dark, but as we approach, something tells me this piece of Windermere is better cared for than the house itself. Caden takes hold of the handle and swings a heavy wooden door wide. As if reading my mind, he says,
Charlie's the one person she lets on the grounds. Helps us with the horses. She loves to ride, but they need a lot of care.
We step inside the stable, and I look down to find Jake pressing against Caden's legs, tongue lolling happily to one side of his spaniel mouth. Caden reaches down to scratch the top of his head. My nostrils are flooded instantly with the sweet tang of hay, the rich, earthy scent of leather, and the smell of the horses themselves, which is distinctly animal. It smells like the country.
This is Jackie O.
Caden gestures toward the tall brown mare in the first stall.
And this is Pike.
Pike is just a bit smaller, and his coat is a dappled white and gray. Caden reaches into Pike's stall to rub his nose, and I take a step back. He watches me with amusement.
I thought all girls were into horses.
Don't they teach you anything about not making binary assumptions at that fancy college of yours? I ask. Caden laughs.
My bad. But Pike's very friendly. Promise.
I look around the rest of the stable. There are 6 stalls in all, but the other 4 appear to be empty. There's a locked door at the back, which is probably where they keep saddles and feed and whatever else gets stored in a horse stable. Both the top and bottom panels of the door to the last stall on the right are closed and latched. Caden heads back toward it, Jake on his heels, and in a minute, the bottom panel is open, and Caden is rustling around inside.
Drink?
He asks, emerging with a bottle of whiskey and 2 cans of Coke. I hesitate. Just the Coke, I say finally. I'm not really drinking right now. He hands it to me, and I'm surprised to find the can is icy cold. You have a fridge back there? Caden grins.
Windermere can be intense. My mother only ever comes out to ride in the mornings, so the stable is empty a lot. Sometimes I need a place to kick back.
I'm tempted to tell him about my run-in with Mrs. Talbot at Tom's birthday party, but things are actually not weird with Caden right now. Easy, relaxed, like they were that first night. I don't want to rock the boat. He closes the stall door and sits on the floor with his back against it. I follow suit across the aisle, cracking open my Coke, and Jake flops down on the stable floor between us. I can justify keeping quiet about Mrs. Talbot, but I do need to tell Caden about Zoe. That I know she was his girlfriend. Is his girlfriend. That I get why my sudden presence next door must have caught him off guard. I watch him take a long swig of soda, then pour a thin stream of whiskey into the can. It's Glenlivet, the good stuff. Kaylee's always been more of a whiskey drinker than I have. I prefer tequila, gin, rum. He makes a few small circles with the can, mixing the whiskey in. My mouth waters slightly, and I tear my eyes away. I know about Zoe, I spit out before I can lose my nerve. Caden's eyes snap up to meet mine. My first week here was a little strange.
I got a few looks.
I bet.
Caden smiles thinly and takes a sip of his drink. But then I met Lou Jenkins at the ice cream shop. He filled me in. I watch the corners of Caden's mouth tug down. He reaches forward and ruffles his hand through Jake's fur.
Not a fan? I ask. I've got nothing against Lou, or his ice cream, but his daughter's a bit much.
I met her, I say. Martina, right?
So you know about the podcast?
I've listened to most of it, I admit. I have one episode left. Seems like she ran out of leads.
Martina and everyone else.
Caden takes another sip.
She wouldn't let up about interviewing me, which I get. But what did she think I was going to tell her that I hadn't already told police? She had this whole theory I was sitting on some critical piece of information. Believe me, if I knew something that could help find Zoe, I would have gone straight to the cops.
I raise the can to my lips and take a long, fizzy sip. I believe him.
And it's not...
His voice trails off, gaze shifting to the can in his hands. It looks like he wants to say something else.
Not what? I prompt. Nothing. You wouldn't understand.
I shift against the stable floor, sitting up straight.
Try me?
Caden presses his lips together and studies me, considering.
Any guy in a relationship with a missing girl is going to get looked at by the police. That's fine. They eliminated me from the investigation. But when you're black, you don't get eliminated by the public, no matter what the cops say. Martina's podcast. It doesn't matter that she tried to be careful. Make it clear she didn't think I directly harmed Zoe. She planted the seed that I was suspicious, hiding things. It's easy enough to assume the boyfriend did it. But the black boyfriend?
He raises the can to his lips. Have people...
I swallow.
Caden's right. I can't understand what the past few months must have been like for him. Sympathize, sure. But I'll always have my whiteness to shield me from the kind of scrutiny he can't escape.
Been outwardly racist?
He finishes for me. I nod.
It's more like what people haven't done. Heron Mills fancies itself liberal. Woke. No one's going to come right out and accuse me to my face. But I've been home for weeks now. There hasn't exactly been a stream of visitors to check on my mom and me, see how we're doing. No one's going out of their way to extend their support, like they are to Zoe's family. I'm not saying it's Martina's fault. It would have happened anyway. But she definitely didn't help.
I'm really sorry. That's so shitty, and... I feel shame pooling in my stomach. That Caden had to spell it out for me.
Anna, you don't have to apologize for them or for listening to the podcast. It's fine.
He takes another long swallow from his can. Okay, it's just, I feel like by being here, I'm making things even worse. I thought it was a bizarre coincidence how much we look alike. But it turns out it's really not. Amelia let Paisley get involved in the hiring process. I'm sure I only got the job because of her. Caden laughs, and the mood in the stable lifts, air particles rearranging. His laughter is light and warm, like the first night.
Figures,
he says.
Paisley loved Zoe. Zoe would bring her over here all the time when she was babysitting. When we were in high school, Paisley had the run of the Windermere grounds. She loved Jake and the horses and the pond out front. The place was in better shape then. My mom was in better shape.
I don't know what surprises me more. The vision of Windermere in all its glory, or the knowledge that Paisley used to spend time here. A lot of time. But before I can dwell on either point, Caden surprises me again.
"We were engaged," he says. "Most people don't know that."
He stares down into his drink. Jake lets out a very human-sounding sigh and readjusts himself on the stable floor.
"I'm getting tired of guarding our secret. And you're not from around here, so."
"I won't tell, I promise."
"I like you, Anna. I'm sorry about last Friday. I didn't expect you to look so much like her. And those cookies."
"What about the cookies?" My grip on the can tightens, and I'm glad to have something to hold on to.
"It was Zoe's signature recipe. Peanut butter, with all sorts of fancy jellies and jams. She used to bake all the time."
"Paisley suggested them." I breathe, thinking of the pink index card among its yellowed companions in the Bellamy's cream stone box. "Zoe's recipe."
"Sure, makes sense. I overreacted."
He reaches out to tap his can lightly against mine in a belated cheers.
"No harm done."
"So you were engaged?" I ask, steering the topic away from my witless blunder and back to Caden's secret. A secret even Martina Green didn't seem to uncover.
"Since the summer after high school," he says. "Only my mother knew. And Zoe's little sister asked her."
"We've met," I say. "She was hanging out with Martina in town last week." Caden nods, then leans his head back against the stall door. A cloudy, unfocused look steals across his eyes.
"It wasn't like we didn't want to tell people. After I proposed, after she said yes, I wanted to tell literally everyone. I thought I might explode with the secret. But we knew what people would think. We were so young. We still had 4 years of college ahead of us. We weren't planning to get married until after we graduated. But still, we knew people would either judge us for it or place all these expectations on our relationship. So we kept it private."
"Makes sense," I say. "Is it hard now?" I flinch and grip the can until the metal dents. "Sorry, that was a brainless question. Of course it's hard. What I mean is, do you wish people knew?"
"I think it's better," he says, the cloudy look gone from his eyes.
He tilts the can back and drains the rest in one long gulp.
"I've already been cast as the grieving boyfriend, or the most likely suspect, depending on who you ask. If people knew we were engaged, it would only raise the stakes, aim even more attention my way. It's like everyone's sure she's dead."
"But you're not?" I strain to keep my voice neutral.
"It's just a hunch," Caden says. "I don't know any more than anyone else, no matter what Martina thinks. But we were together for a long time. I don't have the first clue where Zoe went or why, but if she were dead, I'd know. I'm sure of it."
Jake's ears train back toward Caden, but he keeps his muzzle pressed between his paws. There's a sharp insistence to Caden's words that cuts through the heartache. I drop my eyes to the stable floor. I want to believe him, that Zoe is still alive, that her disappearance is as much a mystery to Caden Talbot as it is to everyone else. I raise my eyes again, search for his, but he's not looking.